look at the source code and have a good idea of exactly what's going on. You know, nowadays, generative AI is an endless series of parameter results on tested observations that I think no one really can get it past the black box algorithm. It's not amenable for figuring out what it's using as its way of judging these things, unfortunately.
Hit you too, KJ.
Yeah, Bruce?
Yeah, on your point, totally agree with that. In fact, my son actually is working in that space, developing apps for nutrition that use AI as, you know, as powering that thing. And nobody really knows how it works. And, you know, at some level, yeah, at some point, you know, what the basics are. But as it acquires more information, you start to lose touch with how many nearly infinite parameters it's actually looking at simultaneously. And you sort of, it's out of your control at some point. Anyway, I'm not particularly afraid of it, but I really don't like when I call someone up or whatever and I hear, in a few words, please tell me what you're calling about. It's like, I would really like to speak to a human, and it's impossible. But I don't know if that's AI, but anyway. That's about all I can say about that. Maybe the other part is maybe someone should coin the phrase, instead of artificial intelligence, maybe genuine stupidity. That's another aspect that maybe we need to develop more. I'm going to put it back to Ned. Thanks for actually treating me with this open arms kind of feeling. I do appreciate it. Everyone on here, thank you very much. 82KJ, I'll be on the side. Thank you.
PhD.
Okay, very good, Bruce. Thank you. I got kicked off of All-Star, but I was able to get right back on. So thank you. Anyone else want to comment about this? I tend to find it, especially because it's probably going to be what kind of crashes the economy any day now. I mean, like I've mentioned before, one of the constants in the press about artificial intelligence is talking about when the bubble's going to burst. So even the guys in charge of it think that the bubble's going to burst any day now. And, you know, there's almost, I think, $1 trillion invested in this field. So, I mean, it's going to have repercussions for years to come. Whether it works or doesn't work, just a matter of $1 trillion evaporating overnight is going to wreak havoc with all of us.
PhD.
Yes, Jim?
Again, with one of my gross oversimplifications. Words have meaning, and artificial intelligence is overly optimistic on the whole thing. If you see a lovely lady with abundant upper stuff, you don't go, those are artificial enhancements. They're fake boobs. This is fake intelligence. It's fake. It's absolute fake. And I'm not saying it doesn't have some utility for mundane purposes. But if you consider it as a serious thing, I think you're an absolute fool. Sorry about the coarseness of that commentary, but that's my feeling on the whole thing.
Okay, the only problem is that that nonsense is connected to $1 trillion of the economy. The whole reason probably that the stock market is still flying high is guys like NVIDIA and Microsoft and these other places. And God knows what the value of OpenAI will be if they ever, you know, figure out a way to turn it into a profitable stock-driven company. So, if a lot of very wealthy guys have invested a good portion of their fortune in it, it doesn't necessarily prove that it's a smart idea, but it certainly kind of makes it an important idea. Even stupid things can destroy economies, and I think this is going to be a perfect example. The big question is what exactly is going to tip the economy over, and I think it's very possibly going to be the AI bubble. It's got over $1 trillion of money invested in the field. You can't make it disappear and expect the economy to run without burping.
Agreed.
Roy, it's maybe we can feed the problem into AI and it can solve itself by figuring out what to do with the lost couple of trillion dollars.
Yeah, that's funny, but that's also part of the in increasing problem. These AIs that are growing bigger with more parameters are looking for more copyright material to violate, and they're running out. So they're starting to unfortunately feed it its own entrails. They're getting stuff on the internet that isn't specifically listed as AI, but obviously is AI. And if you really want to screw AI up, feed it some more AI-generated parameters.
Hal, I need you to unlock the bank account.
Yes, indeed. We're coming to going to have some problems ahead. It's going to be a bumpy ride.
I can't do that, Dave.
Yeah, it's not a new idea that artificial intelligence is going to become psychotic on us. We've been writing about it ever since we've been writing about the subject. So the only one who had a much affection for the concept of AI and robots was Isaac Asimov. He tried to make sense of it with the three laws of robotics. I loved his book. He usually did not write anti-robot or anti-AI books, although they made his book iRobot into an anti-robot plot for I forget his name, the guy who starred in it, who always just does action adventure. So I've never really liked any of the Isaac Asimov stories turned into film. I always feel that they ruin them because Isaac Asimov was more interested in the mechanics and the individuals than the personalities, and films kind of run on action, adventure, and personality. So everyone who's ever bought a license to turn his books into a film have basically ripped it apart and rebuilt it from the bottom up.
Okay, G2RY.
Yes, David.
Well, hope you're having a great evening so far. And I've been listening for a while, and it's all amazing and very interesting conversation. I'm thinking about the robot, and have a companion robot. And, if you're alone or you think you need company or you want to talk to someone, you have the companion robot. What do you think?
I think it's an interesting concept. I don't think the technology has evolved anywhere near to where it's anything more than a publicity stunt type of a situation. It's sort of like these guys who put motors on dolls that kind of look like dogs and have them bark and such, and they have some artificial fur. It's interesting first steps, but I think the technology involved to actually have that be a significant companion is probably decades, if not centuries, away. I don't think generative AI is the method to go to the ultimate intelligent electronics. I think they're going to have to go back to the blackboard and do some more figuring before we have some artificial intelligence truly that's a sentient life form that's based on electrons instead of electrochemicals.
WS2N.
Yes, well.
KG2RY. In 1981,
there was a prototype for a robot, and it had wheels underneath, and the head would turn, the arms would go up and down, and the body would go around and around. And it was powered, it was controlled with a remote control, you know. They use them for parties and entertainment.
Yeah, it's just a gadget. I mean, you know, when I was 5 or 6 years old, for some strange reason, I took a lot of paper and scotch tape and little pieces of popsicle, and I made my own robot. It wasn't mobile. It was kind of stationary, but I mean, what do you want from a 5-year-old? But, Paul, you wanted to say something?
Yes, I put into AI, ASAI, if AI has passed a Turing test. You know, Turing is supposed to be able to identify whether something's truly intelligent, sentient, I guess. And the answer comes up as yes, modern large language models like GPT-4.5 have passed the Turing test in controlled studies. And it goes on and on. So AI thinks the best of itself anyway. Back to you, Roy.
Yeah, well, I mean, the Turing test is not a very sophisticated. It's a very simple test, but, you know, Alan Turing came up with it in the 1950s, so I would be surprised. There are present-day different tests that they use on so-called AIs that have had more problematic results. So, you know, although Turing test was held for many decades as the ultimate, it's kind of just, it depends on the gullibility of the individual talking to the artificial intelligence. Basically, you have a conversation with the artificial intelligence, and they have to come across as not psychotic, which, again, depends on the individual testing. So it's not a completely objective. It's a somewhat subjective test, and it's a relatively easy test for generative AI to sort of fake. Again, the generative AI itself, there's no awareness. It doesn't know why, what it's saying and what it means and what you mean. It's simply stringing things together. So it's more like what they call the Chinese box test, in which you can fake someone being able to speak Chinese by using some intermediary that translates these things. So in the letter of the law, probably it was correct in saying it's passed the Turing test. But the ultimate Turing test has simply moved on to a much more sophisticated one that it hasn't yet.
I saw that moving the goalpost, you know. And then, you know, once they meet that requirement, they'll move the goalpost again, you know. But as far as, you know, 10, 15 years ago, people would consider this what we have today as being intelligent, you know, because they passed that test. So we'll see. Back to you, Roy.
AG2RY.
Yes, yes, David?
There is a very prominent person who believes that AI should be in everything, like a car, especially a car that drives itself, robots, all kinds of internet technology, to get these first-rate chips that are faster, you know, than before. And the idea is that these products are all AI driven. What do you think of that?
I think it's premature. There are things that you need theoretically artificial intelligence to do. Cars can't drive themselves without something that's vaguely reminiscent of a human mind, kind of analyzing the information and responding accordingly. So some things will need AI. Some things probably won't need AI. I hope I do not see an AI toaster. I'm willing to bet you almost anything that if I type into Google AI toaster, there is a product being sold with that list of powers in it. I don't know what an AI would possibly do with a toaster. But I'm sure there are people who are either working on it or are trying to sell it to someone someplace. So there'll be a lot of attempts to sell AI, as there was a lot of attempts to sell Internet access. Korean refrigerators still keep on coming across the country with AI interfaces and web browsers. And most people have not figured out why they need a web browser for a refrigerator. And I kind of agree with them. You know, maybe there'll be an application in the future, but not in the present. So there'll be marketers trying to sell you AI everything. I have no doubt against that.
There's a very well-known manufacturer and provider of media services who create this glasses that give you certain information about what you see. What do you know about that?
They've been around for a while. There's a bunch of different companies working on it. There are different types of visual devices, ranging from just basically wearing a helmet over your head and everything is in virtual space, all the way to a lit projector on the side of one of your lenses that you can query it, who the person is you're starting to talk to, and it does facial recognition. They've been promoting and selling it for years now. There's a very small subset of people who have to have a gadget, and they own those things, but the overwhelming majority have not found it cost-effective. So unless they develop some kind of application or an additional value to it, I think it's going to be for a bunch of guys who just like to have gadgety, you know, they're the guys who are the bleeding edge people. You know, they buy everything that's made. You know, if you manufacture 1,000 units of anything, including AI assisted spork, you'll sell out the 1,000. And the problem is that when you go to 10,000 or 100,000, there's no one left because you've saturated what market it is. So I think these are pipe dreams, and a lot of people are going to flush a lot of money down the toilet developing these technologies until someone like Apple comes up with some kind of twist on the thing, and it pays off for them.
Yeah, but like, if people live in the artificial world, you know, it's going to be a pretty strange time. What's wrong with the normal life, you know, where you see things through your own eyes, you hear things through your own ears, you're not looking at text while you're walking down the street?
Well, it depends on the individual. I remember seeing people walking down the street reading a paperback. I, for the life of me, I don't understand how you can read a paperback and not walk into people. And it seemed that person was walking into more than a few people. So it sort of depends. Again, this is not the overwhelming majority. This is unfortunately a significant portion of our young people who are suffering a great deal these days. It's difficult to find jobs. It's difficult to find friends. It's difficult to get relationships. There's a lot of lonely guys living in their mother's basements playing video games endlessly, and that doesn't really develop social skills. So I feel really bad for the younger generation. We had no choice. We had to live in the real world. These guys can fake it for as long as their parents can support them.
Well, you know, you can have a smartphone with internet access, tracking, hacking, marketing, spamming, scamming, and spying. Or you can have a dumb phone, no internet, and none of those things.
Yeah, but for young people, they can't survive on a dumb phone. That would be like using a blackboard, a chalkboard, instead of a notepad or something. Curious, interesting, a little strange. But I'm not expecting youngsters to see what the technology is capable of, and they see an optimistic future for it. And, you know, for many of these people, this is how they make a vaguely social contact. If you take away their cell phone, they're deaf, dumb, and blind, unfortunately. So I don't think that's going to happen anytime too soon.
Yeah, give them ham radio. Ham radio, intelligent, polite conversation with protocol. Learn something about the world. Ham radio, you know. Whoever thought that young people might like ham radio? It could be sort of like an introduction to the real world.
Well, I don't know about that. I've had interactions with amateur radio operators. Some of them can be quite confusingly interesting in a weird sort of way. You know, some of them are 100% in the world. There are a few who are kind of circling the world also, so who knows. There was someone else who wanted to say something before I wrap this subject up. You want to say something?
K2VHC, Jim.
Okay, Jim, what do you got to say?
I think there was some great wisdom in those comments. Definitely something worth considering there. I'll leave it at that.
Okie doke, I'll accept it. Anyway, thank you all for a very stimulating conversation tonight. I enjoyed myself. I hope you people did as well. Hope you'll join us next Sunday at 8 p.m. when we try and do this all over again. But it's already 10:26 change, so let's move on to WS2N with the SpaceNet report.
Thanks, Roy. And this conversation is way more interesting than listening to what I can talk about. Very good, you know. There's a Waymo car in California, and the car made a U-turn where it wasn't supposed to. A cop pulled it over. Still, I'm trying to figure out how the cop pulled it over. And they're trying to figure out who does the cop give the ticket to? You know, the developer of the AI? Did they give it to Alphabet? Alphabet is, you know, they own the Waymos. Very good. I guess we can talk about that at another time. This is WS2N for the SpaceNet report for the TechNet. Just wanted to talk about 10 new astronauts that were chosen a week or so ago. Let me drop it. Yeah, okay. A little over half of them are women. And, you know, they come out of the military. They come out of the technical fields. You know, one guy here comes out of the Army. And, you know, they compete to try to become one of these 10 new astronauts. And there was 8,000 people that applied. And they came up with these 10. One of them, Anna Menon, she's, they said, 39 years old. She's actually flown in space already. Not for NASA, but for SpaceX. One of the missions that they went up that was privately funded, nothing to do with NASA, was called the Polaris mission. They had gone up with four people. Jared Isaacman was the commander, and another guy and two women. So that was the mission where they redesigned the Falcon 9 to open up the front of it, you know, as a, like a hatch. And they successfully did a spacewalk. Jared was the first one to do it, and then another lady did it. The other one that did it was worked for SpaceX directly. But
this one, Anna Menon, she was just one of the other crew members, they all had to have spacesuits on, you know, so they were all exposed to the vacuum when the door opened up, which is a little weird. They didn't have an airlock system. So, you know, essentially all four were rolling the dice when they did that. With an airlock system, and, you know, whoever goes out, you know, if something terribly went wrong, at least you could, you know, bring two people back. But anyway, she now got chosen by NASA to be one of the 10 new astronauts. Now, out of the 10, you know, I'll make a wild prediction that at least a couple of them might eventually find themselves on the moon. The way they write it up is that, yeah, they might also be it might be possible that they could be one of the early astronauts to make it to Mars. But the way things are going now with NASA, and it's kind of unpredictable. They keep cutting everything, and you know, I just don't see that happening anytime soon. Maybe the next astronaut group that they pick, maybe out of that 10 people or so, maybe I'll be able to say maybe one of them will be able to walk on Mars. Any comments before I move on? This is WS2N. Okay. For years, NASA has been developing a rover to actually ride on the moon, you know, without a crew. And when they were developing, it's called Viper. Viper weighed, I don't know, about 1,200 pounds on Earth. It'll weigh 1/6 of that if they get it to the moon. It's quite large. It stands about 6 feet high. And, you know, spent considerable amount of money to develop Viper. By the way, it stands for Volatiles Investigating Polar Exploration Rover. You know, it had this massive drill that could drill half a dozen feet into the surface of the moon, and all kinds of instruments on board. It had its own lights. It was going to, you know, actually be able to drive into a crater and drive out. Solar powered, so, you know, it wouldn't want to stay down there too long. It comes back out and recharges itself. But because of the way things are going with NASA and the budget, they decided to cancel Viper. This thing was, you know, pretty much put together. I think they were putting the wheels on when they canceled it about a year ago. No, not correction, about 6 months ago. Anyway, they thought, well, maybe a private company might be able to take it over. Sure enough, Blue Origin got the contract for, I think it was $120 million or so, to take over that whole project. Blue Origin has a planned mission going up. They call it the MK-1. It's a large lander. I mean, this lander is probably about, definitely bigger than the LEM, the six LEMs that landed on the moon. And one of them is nearing completion. Blue Origin hopes to launch it maybe by the end of the year. I think that's a little optimistic. Their New Glenn rocket to do that, which is launched once, the heavy lift vehicle, and it was successful. But anyway, if the first lunar lander by Blue Origin makes it to the surface, the second one is already in development. It's the second one, whenever that one would go up, would carry the new Viper robotic rover to the moon. I'd like to see that happen So we'll see. All is not lost with the with Viper. Any comments?
EG2RY.
Hi, Brian. How are you?
QSL Paul, this is David. I hope you're having an excellent evening.
Oh, okay. Sounded like Brian before. Very good. Doing good. And what comment do you have, Dave?
Well, you know, the idea is that AI, they want to use it in every possible way, especially like spacecraft, you know? And the Apollo 9 spacecraft, the Apollo 9, what kind of computer did they have in there?
Well, yeah, the Apollo 9 was very similar to the other Apollo missions that went up. Apollo 9 did not go to the moon. Apollo 9 orbited the Earth. The idea of that one was to test out the LEM, which had not gone to the moon yet either. They needed to make sure the LEM, which is the lunar lander, to be able to maneuver in space and separate from the command module, and then you know, go maybe a couple hundred miles apart in Earth orbit, and then redock, and then eventually, you know, if that was successful, which it was, the three astronauts would then, you know, return in the command module, and that all went well. This way, the next time the LEM was actually flown, it was on Apollo 10, and Apollo 10 was the one that went to the moon, orbited the moon, did everything that Apollo 11 actually did. The only thing it didn't do was land on the moon. I mean, nothing actually separated from the command module in lunar orbit. Started heading down to the surface of the moon, but of course, you know, the plan was to go that far, make sure everything worked. This way, when Apollo 11 went, it would do that last step and actually land on the moon. Of course, that was successful. But the computers that they used were, you know, very rudimentary compared to what, of course, what they have today. Like the memory, all the memory system on board was inductive. They had a million, I don't know, a million, but lots of, it looked like small washers. And each washer would have a coil of wire wrapped through that washer. And put a lot of them in there. Was, you know, the woman, they got the contract for doing it. And, you know, once they were put all together, they were able to actually, you know, whatever they put into memory would be stored kind of like magnetically with these washers. So, I mean, very, you know, very rudimentary, but it did work. The whole system was developed by MIT. And I think it had a 1,000 word or so language. That's it. You know, you would put in different commands, and, you know, certain results were expected to come out. So, yeah, let me drop it. You know, when Apollo was heading to the moon, there was a warning message that came back. I think there was, I'm trying to remember the numbers, 2001, and then there was another one, 2002. And when a message came back, somebody had to read it, you know, and figure out what that meant. And they were doing that on Earth when the message came back. They had to figure out, you know, well, why is the computer sending this message back? You know, like today, the, you know, you would get, you know, words come up or something, or maybe, you know, a voice come up and say, you know, something's wrong. Anyway, what it turned out, as they were nearing the moon, the computer was under too many commands at the same time. It was trying to locate the altitude of the moon, and at the same time, it was running transmissions back to Earth, and one guy back on Earth was able to read the command, you know, whatever it was, 2001. And realized that, don't worry about it, go ahead, and they tell flight, you know, go on that command, and it wound up landing. So, you know, these were the computers worked. They never really had one fail, but you know, all six that landed, you know, very successful, and even the ones that were not planned on landing. You know, in the other missions, don't forget there were, you know, you had Apollo 7, that was a manned mission, all the way to Apollo 17. And out of that group, six of them actually landed on the moon. But they all had these computers that were developed by MIT. Back to you, Dave.
Paul, you know, I have two things to say. One, Apollo 9 had a computer with the capability of a Commodore 64. You know about Commodore 64. And then the question I have, you know, how do people communicate? Was it radio frequency from point to point?
How did they communicate between the lunar lander and the command module? You know, that was UHF, and by the way, they use AM to talk back and forth with one another for a number of reasons. You know, in case they had to do an EVA for any reason, they wanted to be able to. If they used FM, you know, the capture effect would take over, and in case there was like an emergency, we got to do something quick. And one of the people were talking, the emergency wouldn't get through. So they used AM for, you know, like, let's call it local communication, ship to ship, especially when it was down on the moon. But transmitting back to Earth, and they used, I guess that was X-band, you know, 8.4 gig. Back to you, Dave.
On the space side, did they use a dish? And on the ground side, the Earth, did they use like some sophisticated type of antenna, like a directional antenna?
I know there were multiple antennas on both the command module and the LEM. This way, if they turn one way or the other, the metal of the craft wouldn't affect it. So they probably had, you know, at least two antennas, I guess, for that. Once they were on the moon, they had a dish antenna attached to a tripod that they eventually set up, you know, on the EVA for better communications with Earth. But at the same time, they did have to have communications with the command module that, you know, it would take 90 minutes for every orbit. So maybe they'd have about, you know, 10 minutes of conversation with, let's say, Mike Collins on Apollo 11, you know, Aldrin Armstrong would be able to talk to him for a very short period of time as he orbited the moon. But yeah, then they got more involved. The last three missions, 15, 16, and 17, all had rovers when they went up. And the rovers themselves had dishes on it for communications with Earth. You might remember, for instance, the last mission, Apollo 17, when the commander, Gene Cernan, took off, you know, you were looking at the LEM, and the LEM has two parts. It has the descent module, which lands on the moon, and then the ascent module, which is on top of that. When it's time to leave the moon, just the top part leaves. You know, the one engine lights off, and off they go, and they leave the descent module behind. And there's pictures of that happening. You could look it up on the internet. You put an Apollo 17 LEM taking off from the moon, and you see the top part leave. It's like, you know, going up, and then you see the camera following it, you know, following it up as it goes up. You know, who'd they leave behind to do that? So what they had was a camera on board the LEM, on board the rover. They would park the rover a good distance away from the LEM, and the camera had AS-L motor on board, so you could raise it or you could turn it one way or the other. And they designed it where the camera would follow the LEM as it left the surface of the moon.
QSL, I don't really know how they were able to store all of these apparatus in the spacecraft. You know, to get it down on top of the moon itself. You know, there was this camera. This camera made in Sweden, it's called Hasselblad, said that this camera went to the moon numerous times for these very clear, very well-defined imagery of film, you know?
Okay, very good. And by the way, on Apollo 17, point I tried to make was on the rover, they had a dish pointing back to Earth, sending those pictures, not only sending those pictures, but receiving the transmissions from Houston, which, you know, what they did is they would transmit, telling the motor to start, you know, following the LEM as it went, you know, as it was going up. And the guy had to, like, think ahead because there was a second and a half delay before you get to the moon. And they figured that in. That was done manually. No computer. It wasn't computer timed. The guy, I guess, pushed a button and it happened to work perfectly. So, what did you say, Dave? I missed that.
Well, you know, I wonder how they carry all of this apparatus in the spacecraft. All the things that they needed to do, and all the objects they need to do it with on the surface of the moon. And I just, when you were talking about tripods, it came to my mind this camera, which had gone to the moon many times. It's made in Sweden. It's called Hasselblad. And it takes these very clear, well-defined pictures on film, you know?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's how come we have the great, great pictures. When they came back, you know, those pictures were eventually developed. So, you know, you had the TV pictures. The early resolutions on Apollo 11 was terrible. I think it was 250 lines on a black and white. But then they got better. And eventually they had, you know, color transmissions back to Earth. But yeah, the cameras, they did great. They first tested that one, they said, on... It was, the first one was Apollo 7, which just orbited the Earth, and they brought it up, make sure the cameras worked in zero-G and all. And they were kind of very successful. You know, all those cameras were. The one that they had a problem was with a video camera that was sending RF back to Earth, and that one, Alan Bean on Apollo 12, him and Pete Conrad went up, and Alan Bean's job is to set up the camera, and this way we'll have great live pictures like we had with Apollo 11. And when Alan Bean set it up, he accidentally pointed it to the sun, and that was it. He fried that camera. So they don't have any live pictures, you know, TV pictures. Then they, of course, they have the Hasselblad cameras, which, of course, then they use for, you know, for EVA work. And, you know, but they couldn't get those pictures back until they came back to Earth. Also, they had a camera on the outside of the spacecraft. And my guess, it was probably one of them as well. And it was... It took pictures outside the spacecraft, you know, for scientific purposes. They needed to retrieve that camera, or, you know, so that they could get a hold of the film. It was mounted on the service module. Now, when the spacecraft comes back, the service module, back half of it separates from the command module, and that burns up in the atmosphere. So to get that film back, they would do spacewalk in deep space, you know, on the way back from the moon. The guy would go out and retrieve the camera from the outside of the service module, bring that back into the command module, and that was it. And as far as getting stuff to the moon, like the rover, you know, the rover wasn't set up as a big rover going up, but it was an origami type of thing compressed into a million different pieces, you know, and it was mounted on the outside of the LEM. You know, it would land, and then one of the astronauts, when he started doing EVA, they had lanyards that they would pull and eventually lower this LEM down to the surface, and then it would start opening up. The wheels were all bolted in and everything, so it was really compressed. And when they opened it up, they had the equivalent of two beach chairs that they would sit in and ride around on the moon with battery operated. It was an electric car, you know, the electric motors and all of that. Back to you, Dave. WS2N.
KG2RY. QSL, Paul. There was a thought that came into my mind. In 1989, Canon USA, started manufacturing still video cameras that would be used by military. Still video cameras that give you 640 by 480 pixels, and it's just a big, huge camera. My friend had it. He's a teacher, and he made artworks with it, and I guess it's just a piece of history. I don't know if they used them in any space mission. Go ahead.
It doesn't ring a bell, but the standard TV, this HD TV stuff came out, was what, 520 line resolution. So you're saying this one came out with 600 plus, which would have been better, but it still wouldn't have been good as the 720s and the 1080s that they have today, and God knows what else they've come up with. Yeah, I have a 1080. I don't know if those cameras were used for space program or not. Maybe for satellite work, you know. Although 1985, by that time they were sending pictures down, you know, through RF. In the old days, before they could do that, they would actually take film camera up, you know, over let's say Russia. They want to take pictures of, you know, what everything looked like. Those cameras were sent down, with a descent, little small descent modules and parachutes, and that's how they got the film back, you know. And then they would develop and figure out, you know, what your enemies are doing. That took a long time. Then eventually they figured out how to do it with RF. But yeah, I'm not sure about CAN and space program.
82K, Jim.
Which station is that? This is Paul WS2M.
Hi, Paul. Name here is Bruce, 82KJ. I heard this net going on earlier, everyone was kind of gracious enough to just kind of invite me in. Very interesting conversation. But listening to you, it's really incredible, because I'm reliving sitting on the couch with my girlfriend in, you know, 1969, watching the landing on the moon, and I mean, that was just like, it was jaw dropping. It was just incredible. And back over to you.
Yeah, I remember that well. Yeah, let's see, I was, 17 at the time. So, yeah, you know, for the first moon landing. But I used to follow the other ones as well, you know. Started from, you know, I remember my parents talking about, yesterday. That was the anniversary of Sputnik. 1957, October 4th. So I remember hearing, they have an artificial moon up there. As a little kid. So then we followed the space program constantly. You probably went through this too, where they had the TVs and the. And either in the classrooms, in our case, they put a TV down on the end of the hall, and a bunch of classes would go out and try to see this teeny tiny TV down the end of the hallway. When they would have a mission, and they'd get down and, you know,
time
10 seconds
complete.
Before, they'd scrub the mission and, you know, come back again. And that went on, you know, throughout the Mercury programs, and then, of course, the Gemini programs. There were 10-man missions with that. And then, of course, Apollo. Any other comments, Bruce, back to you before we close? Usually we shut down around 11. It's the second part of the net. The main part, of course, is Roy's TechNet. And this is like a little fill-in at the end for the space net. Back to you, Bruce.
All right. Thank you for that. I'm curious about, like, you're so knowledgeable about all the history. Were you... I was actually a defense subcontractor, Laurel Fairchild, before that we kept the Fairchild camera, and they made some of the video stuff that went into space station freedom, you know, things like that. And anyway, I'm just curious because it's very interesting, you know, very specific information that you have. 82KJ, back to you.
I never worked for the for NASA or any of the rocket companies. The work I did was, you know, I worked as a steam fitter, you know, a pipe fitter. So we would do jobs for all kinds of things, commercial buildings. And once in a while, you know, you would get a job where you'd work for Grumman or Brookhaven Lab or something like that. And that's about as close as I got to the space program. So no, just for me, it was just an interest. I followed it, you know, forever. I guess I should have followed the sports more, but I'd rather follow the what was going on in the space program, and that's what happened. And then with ham radio, you know, especially when I first got involved, you know, you listen to these guys and they're talking about, you know, the speed of light and speed of radio waves, and everything seemed related. So, you know, your ears perk up, and next thing you know, you're talking about it on a regular basis. We had a guy here, K2RIW, and Dick, he just fantastic. He did the net. Happened to be interested in the space program. Let me drop it.
And 2OBF, late check-in.
KG2RY. I just want to say 73, thank you very much. KG2RY.
Okay, thanks, Dave, for all your comments and questions. And, that's my history anyway. In the early days, you know, in the early days, you weren't supposed to be promoting things if you worked there or anything. And since I never took a dime from any of these companies, it was easy to get on the air and go on and talk about all these different missions. The other station that wanted to check in, go ahead, this is Paul.
Yeah, good evening. Keith from North Bergen here. Join the conversation, traveling down memory lane.
Okay, very good. Yeah, and we've been doing it for many years here. So like I was saying, Dick loved the space program, and we talked back and forth. And then when he passed, Roy, who took over the TechNet, was good enough to keep this part of it going, and that's what we do. And for now, I'm going to turn it back over to Roy, because we hit 11 o'clock, and that's usually the witching hour. We'll be on tomorrow night, hopefully, for the Limehawk ClubNet, which starts at 8:30. I like this net. This net starts at 8 o'clock. And that's always followed by Swap and Shop, and that's followed by Radio Newsline. And following me now is Roy, AC2GS, WS2N, for the Space Net Report. Back to you, Roy.
Yep, this is AC2GN. GS, rather. Thank you, Paul. Thank you for the SpaceNet report. Thank you for all that you do on the technical net and all that you do for the club. We all appreciate it. And a big thank you to everyone who participated tonight. I had a great time. I hope you did, too. Hope you'll join us in future editions of the technical net. You know, next Sunday at 8, we'll all be back here. So please join me. So as always, I like to end these nets with a couple of quotes from some very clever people. Our own Dick K2RIW would always end his technical nets with the advice to be kind to each other, and that's always good advice. I always like to include good old Epictetus. He was a Roman philosopher. His great line, at least one of his great lines, is, "It's impossible for a man to learn what he thinks he already knows." So please, try and keep your mind open to new ideas, but don't make it so wide open that your brain falls out, because you're going to need it one of these days. To everyone, have a great week. Stay safe. Be well. To those who practice the old religion of the tribes, have a good sukkah. Everyone else, have a great week as well. Stay safe. Be well. And this is AC2GS, and I will be clear after I say, Slava Ukraini.